It all started with some businessmen bankrolling Richard Nixon to become a salesman against socialization. But in the precursor to current campaign finance scandals, Nixon had some explaining to do to keep his place on Eisenhower's Republican ticket, so he took to the airwaves. In making his speech, Nixon left behind lines about a Republican cloth coat and a black and white cocker spaniel named Checkers. The speech, known as the Checkers Speech, saved and bolstered Nixon's political career and set the tone for the 1952 campaign. Just Plain Dick is a political history and more. It's the story of a young man nearing a nervous breakdown and staging a political comeback. Kevin Mattson is the Connor Study Professor of Contemporary History at Ohio University, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be here with you.
The name of the book, Just Plain Dick, Richard Nixon's Checker Speech and the Rocking, Socking Election of 1952. What led you to this particular moment in history?
I had always heard, I think even from being pretty young, the term Checker Speech, and I never really understood fully what it alluded to. I always knew it was an important speech in our history, and I knew that it saved the the political career of Richard Nixon. But as I started to look more into what was going on with the speech and with how it related to the electoral campaign of 1952, I realized that it really had a lot of fascinating layers to it, and it also had a very fascinating political figure, the younger Richard Nixon. So it was at first just to try to explain what this term meant, I think a term that still is in our political lingo today, try to explain the significance of the speech. And then as I got into it, the curiosity just drove me on to tell a kind of wider story, both about Nixon and about kind of American political culture in the early stages of the Cold War.
What is fascinating looking at this from a communications standpoint, it's a fascinating story because television was so new, mm-hmm. and the power was not yet known. We would come to find out later how bad Nixon could be on television. And so it was an odd choice, wasn't it, to get on the airwaves and say, I'm going to set the record straight, as opposed to going to the New York Times or the Washington Post or the LA Times.
Yeah, no, it was. It was a conscious decision, on the part of many of his advisors and also on the part of Nixon himself. Nixon thought he was being creamed by the press, and he saw the press, and that would include the people at the New York Times and other newspapers, as a kind of, a wall between him and the people he wanted to communicate with. So this was one of the first times when, and this was a hatred that Richard Nixon, we know, consistently held to. He hated the media. He hated, when he says the media, he means, reporters and opinion editorial leaders and people like that. He hated those people, and he wanted to find a way to go directly to the people. And television was very new, very fresh. About 50% of Americans owned a television by this point in time. And he knew it was a new platform, and he knew it was a way that he could get around the people who kept describing him in ways that he thought were kind of meaner about what was going on. So it was that direct sort of communication, and it was very fresh. It was very new. And I think in some ways, what's surprising, you're absolutely right, in 1960 with the debates he'll have with Kennedy where he looks bad and comes off poorly. At this point in time, he seemed to really know what to do, and it seemed to really work. He garnered a great deal of support, and he was kept on the ticket because of it.
What do we know about the audience of who watched?
We don't know as much as we would like. That was one of the things that I looked for, and it was difficult to find. One of the things that becomes problematic when you study the history of television and an event like this is that what you do have is you have the multiple telegrams and letters that were sent to Richard Nixon, and saying essentially at the end of the speech what he says is, if I'm going to stay on the ticket, the way I'm going to stay on the ticket is that you contact the Republican National Committee and you tell them you want me to stay on the ticket. And that moment created this enormous amount of telegrams and letters being sent in saying, yes, keep Nixon on, he's a great guy. And if you read the telegrams and the letters, as I have, that are held at the Nixon Library, you'll see they're almost overwhelmingly in favor of Nixon. It's clear that he's reaching people, and you can kind of get a sense of, I would say that the letters there it's a wide range of Americans that are writing in. But I would say that probably it's not always clear as to whether or not Nixon was reaching people who might have been adamantly against him and used the speech to actually turn them around, or whether or not he was speaking to the choir, so to speak, you know, that he was reaching the people who were probably already with him. So it's really hard to tell exactly who's watching the speech. The only thing you can definitively say is that he reached the right people. He got the support that he wanted to get, and it was capable of, you know, convincing Eisenhower that he should keep this young guy on the ticket.
Because it's hard to believe in our current political environment that you would have a candidate that would take to the airwaves for a half hour and people would watch it.
Absolutely right. It's amazing. They really rivet the national attention with this thing. What's most amazing to me about this speech is that the allegations made about Nixon was that Nixon was taking money, setting up a kind of fund, all of which is true, and that money predominantly came from people who had interest in the oil industry, in banking, and in real estate. These are not the industries that most people would think would conjure up an image of what we would call a populist candidate. A person who's, you know, concerned with the average ordinary citizen. And yet what he does in the speech and does so effectively and really rivets the audience's attention with this is that he says, you know, I'm a man of the people. I'm authentic. I understand you. I'm an average Joe. I'm an everyman. My wife wears a typical Republican cloth coat, those things. I have a dog. I have two kids. I have a small little house. Those are the things that what he does is it's a work of genius there, because he's basically been accused of taking money from industries that would not make him into someone who seems to be concerned with average citizens' hopes and dreams, and yet then remodels himself to become a great populist hero, which I think is the way he was seen in 1952. What people were watching when they were watching him on TV that night, and what I think brought a lot of people to watch it, was this sense of, my gosh, a person's political career could be killed unless this is a successful speech. Richard Nixon could be kicked off the ticket, and this could alter the outcome of the 1952 election. So I think he knew it was a kind of crisis feel in the air. He used the airwaves. He kind of captured the airwaves. He was very emotional. He stood up and kind of reached towards the camera at times in a way to try to touch the audience almost. And he was so successful at portraying himself as a kind of average guy, when in fact the original allegations made about, you know, his background was that he didn't look like an average guy, but a candidate who was kind of taking his marching orders from some kind of seemingly, you know, sort of industries.
How much in the speech was he trying to win over Eisenhower as much as he was trying to win over the party and the American people?
It's a good question. It's the story, the relationship between Dick Nixon and Eisenhower during the build up to the speech is just one of the most awkward and difficult relationships you could imagine. Eisenhower is just constantly saying, "Well, you know, I can't make a decision about your political fate. You know, I'm going to have to wait and see how this plays out. I'm going to give it some time." And Nixon is just put it in simple terms, he's freaking out, and he knows that he's got to get Eisenhower to side with him. I think the speech was very much spoken to the American people, but with the special attention towards Eisenhower, to impress Eisenhower, to show the type of support that he could garner, because Eisenhower was really, really aloof. There's a famous conversation that they have on the phone where they're talking about this question about, okay, he's going to make the speech, and then Nixon asks Eisenhower, okay, well, once I make the speech, then you're going to basically, you know, say I welcome you on the ticket, and you're going to be saved on the ticket. And Eisenhower kind of hems and haws, I'm not sure if I'm going to do that, and Nixon literally says, well, there comes a time at every moment at a crisis where you've either got a four-letter word or get off the pot.
Yeah.
It's at that moment that you really get a sense that Nixon is just utterly frustrated with the sort of the sort of standoff attitude that Eisenhower had kind of come into the situation with. So the speech is most certainly directed at the American people, hoping that the American people will write in large numbers in support of him, but it's also aimed directly at Eisenhower. When Eisenhower watches the speech, he turns to one of his advisors and he says, "Looks like you got your money's worth." on this one. And you know, he was clearly impressed, I think, by the kind of dramatic stage performance that Nixon was able to carry off.
Let us talk about that dramatic stage performance, because I think that is what is so incredible in watching it. And I watched the speech last night to refamiliarize myself with it, but it is surprisingly emotional, and that I didn't expect that, and didn't remember that of that emotional tone. And really, you do get the sense that the guy's against the ropes and fighting for his life, and really, yeah, like on the brink.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, he felt that. He was practicing, revising the speech right up to the very point of giving it. So that sort of nervous energy that he carries in there is real. You know, I think that there's components of Richard Nixon who had been, you know, trained as an actor at least partially when he was in college. I think that there's a kind of a sense that, you know, he's acting, that the emotion you get is him being kind of, you know, overly dramatic. On the other hand, he is against the ropes. If this thing doesn't work, if he doesn't come out better in the end, he knows his political career is pretty much over with. So I think he goes in with this incredible. I mean, I honestly think that at some point in time during the sequence of events that the book deals with, that Richard Nixon had something like a nervous breakdown. There are reports of his advisors saying that they saw him in tears at times, that he had a kind of, an emotional, he was kind of on an emotional roller coaster, and of course his relationship with Eisenhower only made that even worse. So when he's going on that stage and you're seeing what you're seeing, which I think is what a lot of people see, that sort of deep emotion and really dramatic sort of feel to it, I think that's in many ways both Nixon acting, but I also think in some ways it's Nixon reflecting the seriousness of the moment.
I've seen him as a guest in old tapes on Jack Parr.
Mm-hmm.
And he came off, there were times in that where he comes off overly confident and a little smarmy. And there's moments of that in the speech as well.
Yes. Yeah, no, he is overly confident. I mean, this is the odd thing about Richard Nixon, is that speech where you feel like he's kind of against the ropes and, you know, he's fighting for his political career. This was a guy who, on the campaign, was an attack dog.
And right.
He was vicious. And in some ways, I think a lot of people saw his role to be the vicious attack dog. When he maligned Adlai Stevenson, who was the Democratic nominee, he was mean. He maligned Adlai Stevenson as being sometimes what he would call fey, wisecracking. The fact that Adlai Stevenson had been divorced and hadn't remarried, a lot of his advisors encouraged him, Nixon's advisors encouraged him to kind of, you know, make an issue of. There's this sort of, you know, really meanness to him, and I think that it's a really odd combination. I think it's the combination that works, right? So it's the combination where he can be mean and he can malign his enemy and his opponents, and yet he can be sweet and touching at the same time and reach out and connect to voters. That combination, having it both, I think is the kind of political genius that Richard Nixon had. But there is a part of it that is very, very cocky, and he has a conversation with Eisenhower after the speech is made, and Eisenhower has said publicly Richard Nixon's going to be on the ticket. Richard Nixon says to him, okay, you know, it's time now to go to war. The enemy's been hurt, and we have to, you know, kind of knock them at the knees, sort of thing. That's not a direct quote, but I mean, that's kind of the feel of what he says to Eisenhower. And, you know, you get a sense there of a guy who's come through an incredible emotional roller coaster and an incredible challenge to his political career, and he is ready and tough as nails and ready to fight. And I think in some ways the campaign after the speech essentially kind of takes on a Nixonian feel to it. The attacks on Stevenson just become, you know, harder and harder and harder. They kind of malign his character. And I think a lot of that is Richard Nixon driving it. So I think, you know, you can look at Richard Nixon as a guy who had both of those sides to his persona. One is the kind of schmaltzy, emotional one where he reaches out to people in the checkers speech, and the other is the tough kind of nail-biting sort of, you know, attack dog sort of persona. But he carried both of those things off.
And it's hard to believe that he, because I've in reading the book, was you have to remind yourself every once in a while of who the general is, you know?
That's right.
He was saying
that's
these amazing things, and that's Ike's
exactly
there,
right,
and he's the general, for God's sakes.
No, that's exactly right. Those conversations where he gets confrontational with Eisenhower, and you know, a lot of the times he'll get confrontational and then he'll kind of walk it back a little bit, because you can you kind of get that sense that he himself is in that moment where he's, you know, he's confronting this guy and he's frustrated and he's saying these things that are really, really kind of nasty. And then I think it probably does dawn on him, oh, you know, this is the guy who pulled America, you know, helped pull America through World War II. Maybe I should be a little bit more respectful.
The American hero.
Exactly.
The title of the book, Just Plain Dick, comes from an editorial that appeared in Variety, and basically calling it the best tradition of American soap opera. And there was a soap opera called Just Plain Bill, and but they have a line about parlaying all the schmaltz and human interest of these types of soap operas.
Yeah, that's what I decided to use for the title, because I thought it was a kind of interesting, you know, obviously perhaps some people would see kind of double entendre meaning to it. I think that that was very interesting. This was one of the first times in which the media that predominantly dealt with, you know, entertainment, with the movies, with records, with, you know, performances, drama performances, this was one of the first times that media deals with political speech, and they are the first to say, wow, this looks an awful lot like all these soap operas that are moving from radio to television during this period of time. It has that sort of feel of schmaltz. It has that sort of visceral emotional feel to it. And they, I think, do, in fact, it's kind of ironic, because I think the entertainment press sometimes does an even better job at treating the speech than does the ordinary kind of, you know, standard New York Times, Washington Post, those types of, you know, old-style journalistic outlets. I think it's the entertainment press who in many ways sees the significance of what Richard Nixon has done, which is to make politics into entertainment, and to rivet an audience in the way he has. They're the ones who I think recognize in some ways the significance of the speech in its most potent ways.
Well, it is fun saying this on the radio without getting in trouble. The name of the book, Just Plain Dick, Richard Nixon's Checkers Speech and the Rocking Socking Election of 1952. Kevin Mattson is the author. Kevin, this is really fascinating stuff. And I, like you, I've heard about it all my life. And just reading it and putting it in the context was endlessly fascinating. And you did a great job. Thank you very much for the book and for sharing with us this morning.
Thanks for having me on.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Just Plain Dick. It is published by Bloomsbury. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.